But I remember one specific story where, or one specific moment that actually tells a story in this book, is that there was a guard that played for the University of Virginia who was like 6'3" and so fast. And when I was in high school, I hated running. I was slow. But, you know, to get better at running, you actually have to run. You have to practice it. You know, it wasn't that I was, you know, perpetually slow. It was you have to do it to get better at it, you know, and that I didn't understand that concept at the time, you know. And so comparing myself to her, where I was a center in high school, 6 feet tall center, to look at her, a 6'3" guard that could run like a jackrabbit, I was like, wow, she's 3 inches taller than me and way faster. And the centers are going to be like 5 inches taller than me. So I just compared myself by all those anthropometrics. And it just didn't seem like a fit. You know, I was like, wow, they're just bigger than I am.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Lindsay Dare Shoup. Yes, her middle name really is Dare. Lindsay is a coach, an author, and a lifelong athlete. She's an Olympic gold medalist, three-time world champion, and is in the National Rowing Hall of Fame. Lindsay almost missed having all of the success and adventure that she has had in her life because of her mindset, the beliefs that she had when she was in high school and just starting college. But she made some key decisions that changed the direction of her life. I'm excited to share her story with you, and I hope you enjoy listening in on my conversation with Lindsay Dare Shoup.
I had a contact at Audible, and because I published the book in print before I did the audiobook, she was like, I would love to purchase this, but I can't because you already did. Like, they have a whole thing where it's like, you know, they want everything to be released all at once. And so the reason I bring that up is because she was like, but do you mind if I send this to our production guy? Cause it's really good. And so I actually ended up doing an interview or an audition to just read other people's audiobooks for them.
Wow.
Yeah, which was really fun. But of course it's like, you know, you can do a zillion things and you really kind of have to pick what you want to do and get good at that. But they were particularly, let me turn my phone off too. Particularly interested in how I did it, because I did it through the pandemic. I did it in my closet. I soundproofed audio, you know, with two 12 by 12 by 2 inch acoustic foam, and did the whole thing. Just came home after work and read a few chapters. And there really is no, like, as long as you take care of yourself physically, all of the things that you would do to be healthy as an athlete, you need to do to be healthy as a reader as well, because all of the small things that impact your voice. And so you don't want your voice to be dramatically different from day to day. So I just did all the things that I already do. But yeah, you know, it's funny because I think like a handful of people don't normally leave audiobook specific reviews, and everybody's like, oh, it's so great. And this one person literally left like a 1-star or something like that. And I was like, huh, let me check out that. And the review literally says, like, love the story, love the messages. Like, that's how the review starts. And I'm like, okay. So I was like, I think that they didn't mean to put what they put, but, you know, it is what it is. But yeah.
that's funny.
Yeah.
And I remember back, way back, I was much younger. There was a mail order thing. It's like how to make money reading books. And it was one of those back pre-internet. Yeah. And, you know, they were talking about being a proofreader, being an editor. And they also talked about doing audio. You know, that was back when you had to, you know, you'd have to record on a, some
on
sort
a tape
of
or something
hard,
like that,
hard media.
You know, and I've always sorry. Go ahead.
That always intrigued me. And that's just, I thought that was interesting. But I hear oftentimes authors reading their own books, and sometimes it goes well and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. You know, and they spoke on that they prefer, especially if someone's writing something that's about their story, their life, they prefer the author to read it. If it's a nonfiction and you have to have, or if it's a fiction and you need mm-hmm. multiple voices and things like that, that becomes more challenging, because if you have to read, mm-hmm. you know, two voices is one thing, but if you're reading an array of characters, you have to remember which voice goes with which one, you know? And that yes. is something that, that
and the,
actors...
And the people who do that are very talented.
Yes, yes. And so, but in the rare instance that someone's voice just is not right, which is very rare, they will specifically request to have someone else. Like the production team will say, you know, look, this is just not working out. Because if the reviews come back that people love the book, they love the thing, but the people at Audible actually gave me an example that someone left a review that they just couldn't get past the author's voice of this particular book. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the book was, but the review was like, you know, if you can, it reminded me of the dog from Up, which I'm not completely familiar with what that would sound like, but I wouldn't want my audio.
Yeah, I never saw the movie. Like, so into that. That's yeah. funny.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, because I authored a book back in 2014, I believe.
Okay.
And it, you know, kind of considered doing that. I was like, oh, that just, that was just, I spent so much effort writing the book. I was like, no, I'm done.
Yeah. I mean, it's honestly easier than it seems. It takes as long, you know, unless you like stumble and fumble through it, but because you wrote it, you're super familiar with it. And like, for me, this story, mm-hmm. the book that I, my actual book.
Yes. I like the title.
that one book. Like everything is in my head like a movie, you know, like I remember all the moments, I know mm-hmm. what the people's voices sound like, and there is no special way that you have to read it. And because you've read it so many times, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like you write a book and you never read right. it again. You read it so many mm-hmm. times just to finish yeah, right, the thing.
Right. Yeah. You probably wrote it so many times.
Yes. Yes. You seriously write it a billion different times, and then you read it out loud too, several times. And so you're just so familiar with it by the time you go to read it. At first, I thought I had to do it a specific, like, ooh, I'm doing an audiobook. I have to do it a special way. That was definitely not the case. The more that I just read it mm-hmm. as if I would read it to someone, the better it went, the more that mm-hmm. it flowed. And it just went by really, really fast. And it was definitely worth doing. Yeah,
that's cool. That's because I always admire people who can do that. And I love the sound of your voice. I could see how it'll be great. So is it out? Is audiobook then released?
Oh yeah. You can get it on, Audible.
Has it been released?
Yeah. Yeah, it has been. I can't remember when July, I think I released it. So it's been out for almost a year now, actually, the audiobook. So,
cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it's people have said, you know, it's like you're just there reading me the story, which is what it is.
That's a great compliment.
Platforms. Yeah.
That's a great compliment. That's cool. I appreciate you taking time to talk to me. What I wanted to find out, I mean, you are an Olympic rower. I mean, that's kind of the thing that you're known for. But you didn't start out, you know, you started out doing a lot of different sports. So how did you make your way through high school, college, and then land in rowing?
Well, I mean, I've always been big for my age. You know, I started kindergarten when I was 4, you know, because I was tall enough. And so when you are a little bit big for your age, you kind of get nudged into sports and things that people, oh, you're tall, you'd be good at this, you know? And so I played all the mm-hmm. sports growing up. I played a lot of different sports growing up. At one point in time, I was the only girl on the all boys baseball team, you know? So whatever sport was available,
oh, really?
I did it. Yeah. I mean, I played like almost a dozen different sports growing up. And I grew up with a bunch of boys, so that was just kind of part of life, you know, and I loved playing sports. I, you know, in retrospect, you know, there are all the different things of like, they keep you organized, they keep you fit, they keep you busy. For my family, mm-hmm. it was like a little babysitter almost.
Teach you how to work with a team. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I just really loved being around teammates. And it wasn't until, you know, the last year or so that a friend of mine said, well, you might not have specialized in a sport, but you kind of specialized in teams, you know, and even though, you know, I played on all these teams throughout my life, basketball, I played for like 10 years. Volleyball was my favorite sport. I played it 4 years. I didn't have the confidence to play a sport in college because the images that I held in my mind of what it would take to do that, I just thought I was small and slow relative to collegiate athletes. Like, sure, I could be a high school athlete, but college was reserved for special people. And I wasn't one of those special people. And I kind of jokingly say now that luckily I didn't have the confidence when I graduated from high school at 17 years old, because I, you know, that's the whole reason why I wrote the book, is because it's a very kind of serendipitous story with a lot of details of how I stumbled upon rowing. But it really boils down to, I bumped into the rowing coach on campus at the University of Virginia on December 1st of my junior year in college at the University of Virginia, like I said. And I had not been playing on an organized sports team for 2.5 years, and bumped into him. It was one of those things where you're tall, you're athletic, or have been in your past. You should try it. And that's what I did. I was on a path where, for 2.5 years after high school, I started, because I left sports behind, I started to gain weight and my grades started to come down, and I was kind of wandering and not really sure of what I wanted to do. And rowing was an opportunity to just do something different, give something different a try, even though I knew nothing about it. I just knew that I didn't want to keep wandering around and gaining more weight and my grades dropping. So enter rowing, and it really righted the ship. Got fit again. Got to be around teammates. Grades went through the roof.
Interesting that your grades dropped as well. That what was kind of the, I mean, that sounds like kind of a not only a physical downward spiral, but you had some mental or some psychological things going on as well.
Yeah. You know, you're the first person to phrase that way, actually. Yeah. Because throughout high school, sports kept me organized. You know, they just physical activity mm-hmm. alone, we know, is good for your mind. Also just the habit that if I didn't do my homework or I didn't do well in my classes, I wasn't allowed to play sports. That was the school rule, you know? And so these habits that I had ingrained throughout my, you know, kindergarten through 12th grade years, were, I guess, you know, immaturely tied to athletics rather than truly ingrained habits. It was like the kind of the ends justify the, you know, like, yeah, you had to do that in order to get to play sport. So remove the sport, and all of a sudden it was like, well, I don't have to do that now, you know? And so you're away from structure. And you take away the structure of your parents kind of helping guide you, but you also take away the structure of your sport and your teammates guiding you. You kind of don't have any role models at that point, you know? So yeah, I definitely, when sports exited my life, I didn't have the same kind of outlets that were really helping me be productive and maximally, you know, productive, just being me being the best version of me, you know, being better at being mm-hmm. me. And rowing certainly helped me rediscover a lot of that and then some.
What do you think it was that made your self-image say, I can't do that? I mean, you said that when you saw yourself in high school, I mean, was it a smaller school? And you kind of stood out, or what led to that looking outward and saying, oh, those people are so much better, I shouldn't even try?
Yeah. I mean, I was at a small school, for the academics. I was one of, I mean, it was about a 50-50 split, but I was one of the better athletes in the school just by physical body and how I had grown up, you know. So that was my, oh, it's a small school, I'm good just because of that. Even though, you know, like, we would go play teams that were much larger, much bigger schools, and I would still score the points and we would win games and all of these things. So there were like small little, you know, nudges of, you could actually be pretty good at this. You know, my high school basketball coach, some college coaches were, you know, reaching out to him and wondering what I was going to do after high school. And I just kind of laughed it off, like, oh, those people must be crazy. But because I did grow up not far outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, which is where the University of Virginia is, I grew up watching a lot of those athletes. And there are many of them that I have in my mind. Shoot, Dawn Staley was a Virginia athlete. You know, like, she is an absolute standout at every level of the game, from athlete all the way through coach, to this day, you know. But I remember one specific story where, or one specific moment that I actually tell as a story in this book, is that There was a guard that played for the University of Virginia who was like 6'3" and so fast. And when I was in high school, I hated running. I was slow. But, you know, to get better at running, you actually have to run. You have to practice it. You know, it wasn't that I was, you know, perpetually slow. It was you have to do it to get better at it, you know, and that I didn't understand that concept at the time, you know. And so comparing myself to her, where I was a center in high school, 6-foot-tall center, to look at her, a 6-foot-3 guard that could run like a jackrabbit, I was like, wow, she's 3 inches taller than me and way faster. And the centers are going to be like 5 inches taller than me. So I just compared myself by all those anthropometrics, and it just didn't seem like a fit. You know, I was like, wow, they're just bigger than I am.
So you didn't look, do you, was that the college that you were really looking to attend and didn't want to go to any others? A lot of athletes, I know they say, oh, here's my first choice. And they would look then, it's like, well, you know, maybe I couldn't compete there, but maybe I could go to a smaller school or a different conference and still be able to play college.
Yeah. I mean,
anything in your mind that way?
It wasn't so much that, you know, that I could have maybe gone somewhere else. I just held everything as that standard. You know, Virginia is an ACC school. So then all the other ACC schools involved in there, for some reason, and I can't remember specifically why, UCLA seemed like a neat place to go. I remember playing when I was in 10th grade, went to a basketball tournament in New Jersey, and there was a team from California. And I was like, wow, a team from California. That's so cool. That's so far away. And for some reason, I just thought UCLA would be a really neat place to go to college, but there wasn't any particular draw. At the time, without really significant internet search capability and without kind of the awareness of what other schools are out there. Plus, I wasn't completely certain about what I wanted to study. At one point in time, I wanted to be a large animal vet, you know, but there was just a lot of uncertainty. I ended up majoring in Spanish when I was in college because I loved Spanish. I loved art and I loved art history, you know, so I have this whole creative side, even though, you know, I was good at math and science as well, but it was almost like I had all of these options. So I wasn't sure. You know, I guess that falls into the analysis paralysis kind of phrase that we use today. But like all these options, and so you're like, oh, I could be good at all of those things. Who knows? You know. When it came down to it, UVA was a fantastic school. It was close by. It was in state, and it was something my parents could afford. You know, not having a scholarship opportunity. So I wanted to go to the best school that we could possibly afford, and Virginia seemed like it.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, in-state tuition is a great thing. I mean, that's often the deciding factor for a lot of students. And
yeah,
so the rowing. I mean, you didn't know anything, and I mean, I would be in your situation too. I see rowers, you know, out. I mean, the lake where I run, there's a rowing club, and in fact, one of the trails I run goes right through where they stage their boats and the dock. Okay. And so, you know, I see the rowers out there, but I have absolutely no idea about the sport. I mean, I've even seen some of the competitions on the lake, but it's still kind of what is as far as what does it take to be an athlete in rowing?
When my teammates and I won the Olympics, 5 of us learned how to row in college. You know, 5 of us that were standing there together, we literally were the first woman that won Olympic gold for the United States at 2000 meters. Like we were the first ones to do it. And
you were the first team to win.
Win gold in 2000 meters. Yeah. Yeah. You know, they subsequently put us in the Hall of Fame and everything. And 5 of us learned how to row in college, 2 of us after freshman year. My teammate, Susan Francia, she learned, in 10th grade in her sophomore year. And I was in the spring of my junior year. And so it almost seems like kind of being a late bloomer is really helpful because you continue to grow, you kind of continue to find your awareness, and not being overly strong when you're young is actually very helpful in rowing. Because if you're incredibly strong at a young age, you can actually get in your own way. And it takes away from your ability to really develop what we call boat feel. Which is the free speed in the boat. That's when you watch a swimmer who's incredibly fit, but not as fast as the person that just really nails the technique. It's amazing. You can watch two people dive into a pool and one can be exponentially faster, even if they don't seem as fit, because they get the nuances of the stroke. and rowing is the same way. Mm-hmm. There are nuances of that stroke that take time to identify. But in my, you know, in my opinion, in what I've noticed as an athlete and as a coach, is that if you're lanky, like you have a short torso, long arms and legs, long legs in particular, that helps you have better leverage while minimizing, you know, injury risk or minimizing the energy needed in your midsection, like to your back. And then, you know, being a really good teammate, because it's not about just what you add to the boat itself. It's what you get out of your teammates that are in the boat with you. You know, you really need to work seamlessly with the other people that are there, because if you go in and just go gangbusters and over effort it when the boat isn't ready for it, you can actually waste a lot of energy and make the boat go slower as a result. So, you know, there's cardiorespiratory fitness, there's length of limb, there's being a good teammate, being able to be consistent and stay healthy is a huge piece of it.
So what kind of injuries do rowers? I mean, because I look at rowers and I look at rowing. Runners, you know, 85% of runners get injured every year. Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. you know, that it's kind of a high impact sport. And, you know, as I watch people rowing, it's like a lot of people would say it doesn't look, I know there's a lot of effort involved in it, but it's, mm-hmm. you know, you're sitting down, you're just moving, yeah. you know, it does, there's no impact. And so what kind of injuries do you get?
Yeah. A lot of injuries. This is a huge, you know, a huge area of interest of mine. And this is where I'm like, now I'm thinking about getting a PhD in sports medicine so that I can kind of reverse engineer injury to help people better teach technique. You know, like this is the cause of, mm-hmm. you know, help coaches and help athletes connect those dots to be more intuitive about the sport. But a lot of very common injuries, especially in the early years of rowing, are in the back, you know, L4, L5, L5S1, because that's the biggest hinge in the body. And you're really just taking a lot of strokes moving across that hinge. It's also because you use that in daily life. So you're basically doing all the activities of daily life plus that underload. But back injuries and rib injuries are the most common. And one of our physical therapists with US Rowing said to me years ago that the injury is really, you know, backs were the thing once upon a time. So everybody strengthened their core and then it just goes up the link. So what's the next weakest link is going to be around the ribs. And then you go up from there once everybody's really strong in the middle and it turns into shoulder problems. There are a lot of other, you know, injury risks out there, especially with all the changes in the way that we're lifting and everything. And it's all about just having good technique when you're in the boat, when you're out of the boat. So overuse is typically very rare that it would be a traumatic injury, but usually overuse and stress related injuries.
Usually overuse. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or runners suffer overuse as well. And very similar. I mean, you talk about technique. How do you learn the technique? I mean, you know, you hand somebody an oar, sit them down in the boat and say row.
Yeah. Yeah.
try to keep up. I mean,
how I learned. Well, but, you know, we joke about it, but it's true, because I started in the spring of my junior year. So I kind of came in on my own. And really the first pieces of advice that I got were, you know, here's the stuff. If you have questions, ask your teammates. You know, that was kind of how it went on day one mm-hmm. through five, at least.
I'm certified as a Qi running instructor. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I'm often looking at form, and I mean, nobody told me anything about running form when I was, you know, in any sport. And most people I've talked to, coaches don't talk about, you know, running efficiently or running, there are some who do, but most of them, it was just like running should be something that you just automatically know how to do.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it sounds like they applied the same thing to you.
You
go.
There's, you know, there's a basic. It's kind of similar to running. You know, your body understands how to do it. You know, it's a biological, we're biologically wired for locomotion, you know? So when it comes to running, even as a baby, you're like you learn how to walk and you're kind of falling on yourself. And so you start with the foundation that's very rudimentary and you just kind of figure out how that goes. It's just, a speeded up form of walking, you know, and And then over time, as you want to perform more and more, then you can start to break down the mechanics of the motion itself. And rowing is not that different, because it is a matter of levers and loads, and how would one want to leverage something that is, that could be potentially heavy, you know? And so you, you watch the basic motion, you see it, and then you get a little bit of basic instruction. And the whole point is to keep it very simple in the beginning. And it, for me, I, you know, over the last 12 plus years now of coaching at basically every level that, that exists, except Division III NCAA. That's like the only level I have yet to coach. One and two, and then everybody else, you know, it's all in there. Is that we overcomplicate it. And when you really think about it, it is, how might one want to move a heavy object repeatedly for prolonged periods of time while reducing risk of injury? Because when you look at performance optimization, it actually, if you're doing it right, reduces your risk for injury. Because you look at levers and loads, and you look at joint integrity. How can I keep my joints, like reduce wear, like reduce load on my joints, reduce extraneous energy lost on my joints? And the way that I look at it is, you know, you can, our national team coach at one point in time, I have this crazy memory of things that he said. He said, hang off your structure, you know? And to me, what that meant was, my bones are strong. You know, I want to use my energy to go fast. I want to use my energy to get to the finish line first. So I don't want to waste, I don't want to lose even micro amounts of energy anywhere. So I'm looking at keeping my joints in the locations that would allow my bones to be optimally efficient there. If my joints get out, so like if my shoulder comes out too far, and too far is a loose term, there's more technical breakdown to that, then my muscles have to work to keep my joint together. So let me keep my joint a little bit more intact so that the muscles don't have to waste energy just to hold my arm together. They can use that energy to go fast. And so that's really like, you want to stay pretty intact. You want to stay in a compact position. If you might want to pick up a heavy box, you're going to get close to it. You're going to hold, grab it low, and you're probably going to keep everything really squared off. And so you do the same types of things in rowing. We could do like 2 hours of technical breakdown, but no reason to.
But that makes But that makes it understandable. I mean, that, that your bones, there's an alignment. That is most efficient for the way you hold your, the way you hold your skeletal
joint
muscles.
Integrity, mechanical efficiency. That's what you're looking for.
And running is very similar. And you know, if you're bringing your heels too far forward, you're actually have a breaking action when you hit the ground. And so
the overstriding, you know, underneath the habit of
overstriding. And so I'd imagine it sounds like you had the same kind of thing in the rowing. So, so you went
there,
through,
there are
you
a
went
lot
through
of
college.
Overlaps.
You went through college as a rower. How did you end up saying like, hey, let's, or you know, did someone notice you as far as, getting you into the Olympics?
Yeah. You know, after my, my first 5 days, anyone out there that has ever heard of rowing, that participates in rowing, I did a 2000 meter 2K. I did an erg test on my fifth day of rowing practice. I did an erg test and I went 7 minutes and 58 seconds.
A what test?
A test on the rowing machine. So like a physiological test, the same way that you might do a mile run. Erg, E-R-G.
You said erg and I was like, okay, that.
What is that? Yeah, the rowing machine. Yes. No, I apologize for that. The rowing machine. Technically, an erg is just a measure of energy, you know, so the rowing ergometer. You know, my fifth day on the team did a 2K. Same way that you might go out and do, okay, let's do a mile run test on your fifth day or first time out, fifth time out ever running, right? Do a mile run. Well, I did a 2000 meters on the rowing machine and my time was 7 minutes and 58 seconds, which is not fast for the national team standards, but for a person just starting out, that's not bad. Within a year, I went a minute faster. So I went 6:58. So if you break 6-7 minutes, then that starts to turn some heads like, oh, okay. Especially if you do it in your first year of rowing. So because of that, my college coach was kind of like watching me develop over that first year of time. But also within the first probably 6 or 8 months that I was on the team, the national team coach kind of does a tour of the country, going to kind of some of the biggest programs in women's collegiate rowing. And just to scout athletes just to take a look. If a college coach says, hey, I've got a kid you should really look at, you should really think about, then they'll go check them out. And so he came to look at a teammate of mine, and he ended up kind of spotting out three others of us that he thought, huh, what about those people? And I think for me, it was kind of how I was built, that I was pretty new. And then you combine that with the fact that I had gone, or that I was improving pretty quickly on the rowing machine in terms of my physiology, and that I was a good teammate. You know, my college coach would say that I had a great attitude and was willing to do a lot of hard work. So those are things that kind of piqued the interest of my college coach and the national team coach. And so then I was subsequently invited to kind of a pre-elite camp, which is almost like a novice team for the national team, where you kind of get in a feel for what it would be like to train with the national team, and mm-hmm. the coach can kind of get an eye on you, and you can work with a group of people that you might potentially be training with in the future. Did that, loved it, wanted to just keep doing it. You know, rowing changed the entire course of my life for the infinitely better. And it was like, how could I not want to do more of this? I want to be the best at this that I can possibly be. And what does that take? If the national team will let me train with them, then that's what I'm going to do. You know, if you want to be the best you can be, you find the best and you go train with them. And so luckily I got invited to some camps because of some performance measures, and I guess because of the person I am. And it just kind of went on from there. A lot of ups and downs from first day of national team practice to the Olympics. But over the course of my time, for the first 4 years that I trained with the national team, I went from the bottom of the heap to, I mean, we're talking like number 50 something, you know, in the hierarchy of the people at the time, you know, number, I mean, like the bottom of the heap of my, at the time of my second pre-elite camp. And within a year of that, I became the fastest starboard in the country. So the fastest that rowed my side of the boat. You have starboards, you have ports, and then you have scullers. And so those are kind of the three types of rowing that you can do. And I raced in two events at my first world championships. We got fourth and sixth place at my first worlds. My second world championships, my teammates and I won and broke the world record. Third world championships, we won again. And then the Olympics was the fourth one, and we won that. So, when we won our first world championships together and broke the world record, that was the first in a string of 11 straight years of the United States not losing that particular event, which is technically the longest streak, of any sport internationally for men or women. If you count world championships and Olympic games. People will say, oh, well, they lost a World Cup here and there, but that's for the world championships and the Olympics, like for all the big shows that you can have in any given year. 11 straight years is the longest streak. So yeah.
I made the decision a while back that I wouldn't ask companies to sponsor this show. It's not that I didn't believe in their products. There's a lot of good products out there that I would love to promote. I just wanted to have the freedom to put the show together in a way that felt right to me. And sponsors often want to dictate where their advertisements go in the show. At the same time, you know, I wanted to give you who listen and who like the show to support this show if you chose to. So I decided to start putting this short break in the middle to talk about a couple of offers that I've got. At the UltraMindsetPodcast.run, you can find a link to Amazon. It's an affiliate link. That means if you click on the link and then make a purchase, I get a small percentage from certain items. It doesn't cost you any extra. And you may have used affiliate links before when you purchase something from Amazon. If you've ever seen one of those top 10 best products review things, that they're all over. And I know I check those out when I want to buy products. Those links to the products, because I mean, they give you the review, tell you, and if you want to buy it right then, you click on the link. The people who wrote that and put that top 10 list together will get a small percentage because it's an affiliate link. Now, I'm not pushing any products. I'm not going to be doing top 10 reviews here on the show. I only set this up just to ask that you would consider grabbing that link from the UltraMindsetPodcast.run and use it when you shop Amazon. That's it. It will help me keep the lights on here at the podcast. I truly appreciate your support, and thanks a lot for listening. Wow. So how many people on the team? How many people are in the boat normally?
So that particular event?
I've seen that there's I think are there several there are several different sizes of teams, I think.
Yes. Yes. So the team itself, I mean, the United States carries one of the largest overall teams, but there are 14 events at the Olympic Games. And as of this just past game, so the 2021 Games, there were 7 events for men and 7 events for women. And the particular event that my teammates and I won at the Olympics was women's 8. And so there are 8 rowers and 1 coxswain, so 9 people total in that particular event.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen they also do sometimes singles as well as, I think, are there four person teams?
Yeah. So you have sweeping and sculling. Sculling is where each person has 2 oars. So if you have 1 person in the boat, that person has 2 oars. So that's the single. Then there's a double, which is 2 people, 2 oars each. A quad, which is 4 people with 2 oars each. So then you have 8 oars there. On the sweep side, which is each person just has 1 oar. There's a pair, which is 2 people. There's a 4, which is 4 people, no coxswain. And then there's the 8, which is the only coxed event. So there's 8 people, 8 oars, 1 coxswain.
So what does the coxswain do?
Coxswain, you know, at the very, like, the number one rule for anything, right? It's like any coach, their number one rule is safety. Safety is their priority. We're not looking where we're going. And they have a 60-foot long vessel that can go very, very fast. And it's very pointy, so you can do a lot of harm with that if you aren't careful. But they steer, they call the race plan, you know, they keep everybody, they're not, you know, doing the Viking ship, row, row, row. But they are that tiny voice of reassurance inside your head when you need it most. You know, even when your mind goes blank in the middle of a race because you are going that flat out, you know, you were that much in the flow, you know, you black out and your body knows what to do. The coxswain kind of is able to know when the races become the most challenging, and they can get right in there and call everyone back to attention and tell you that you have more when you feel completely gassed. And it's that our coxswain in particular, name was Mary at the time, Mary Whipple, now Mary Murray. I get in a boat with her every now and again and race. And she is just fantastic at what she does. And part of it is because she's an athlete herself, but she also gets to know her athletes without pretending like she knows more than her athletes. You know, at one point in time, she did say, like, without them, I don't get across the finish line. You know, she doesn't make it about her. She's not bossy. She doesn't make it about being the coach or being the boss. She's part of the team. And that's really what matters most. We just all have different roles. So it's the one thing I still just can't figure out is that they're usually a foot shorter than everyone else. And they sit in an 8, you sit in the back. So the coxswain is and by the back, I mean the stern. So she's the last, he or she, depending on if you're male or female rower, she's the last person across the finish line, and it's a 60-foot long boat. And she has someone who's more than a foot taller than her sitting right in front of her. So she can't actually see the other end of the boat. So to be able to see where she's going, I think is just the most incredible thing. I still can't quite figure out. You literally, it would be like wearing blinders while trying to drive your car or putting a cone right in front of your steering wheel and trying to drive. Well, that's probably more of an explanation than you were looking for, but.
Well, yeah, I was, you know, hearing what you say, how would she know what the people in the front of the boat are doing? I'm assuming the balance is a big thing and she can't just like lean out to the side and.
Yep. Yeah. She can't lean and look. She can see the oars, and the oars are what matter most. Like, she can see everybody's oars because they stick out far enough from the sides of the boat. So she can actually see what's going on with the blades. And if you as a coxswain understand the sport, you probably know some of the causes of what the blade is doing. There's a cause and effect with every single thing that happens with the blade. And she can give you feedback on that. If X is happening, it might be, you know, try this, you know, and she'll throw in a drill for the whole boat to do that'll help kind of dial that in. So yeah, she can't see the body, but she can see the blade. And that's actually what you do as a coach too, is you look at the blade and you go, okay, what might cause that? Let me take a look at the person. Okay, now. But you start with the blade, with what the blade is doing relative to the water and the boat, and reverse engineer.
So then during the race, would she call out corrections to individual rowers, or
Not usually, unless it's something catastrophic. In our the first world championships that we won, when we broke the world record, in the middle of it, the weather was just so bad. It was, you know, white capping water. It was not flat by any stretch of the imagination. The water was a mess. And at one point in the middle of the race, the commentators even said, you know, it'll be tough to set a world best time with a shipwreck like that. And the boat just started going crazy because someone had clipped a wave and it knocked the boat over one direction a little bit, which made someone else clip a wave, which knocked it even farther. So it really lurched side to side a few times. And so then she would have to make a call to correct that situation, which was just everybody tapped down to get the blades up and away from the water. But usually not a technical thing, because at that point, on race day, you go with what you got, right? You got to focus on the stay together, dial in, go hard.
So you, in the world record, you all just flipped your blades out of the water to get your boat right again.
It was, I mean, well, we tapped down a little bit more so that we wouldn't hit any more waves. You know, it was just like, it was not pretty at that point in the race at all. I mean, imagine had we not, you know, clipped a wave or two, we might have still have the world record. It took about 7 years, I think, before anyone broke it, but it got broken again.
So what changed? I mean, you said the United States hadn't done well in rowing for many years, and then all of a sudden, was it coaching? Was it the caliber of athletes that came in? I mean, you know, you came on the scene, but what were the other factors that helped the United States kind of surge ahead in rowing?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there are a lot of things, and we can speculate about a lot of different causes. You know, I love looking at patterns. The coaching staff kind of changed over. The old assistant coach became the head coach. A new kind of guard, a new crop of athletes came in, and the way that they kind of raised us, if for lack of a better phrase, through the sport was in small groups rather than big groups at a time. It was let's pick a smaller crop and really spend more time letting them develop in small boats, which would give us more technical dexterity. Women's NCAA rowing also became, or women's rowing became an NCAA sanctioned sport in the mid 90s. So 1996, I believe it was. And so that meant the growth of collegiate rowing, women's in particular, blossomed from there. So give it a handful of years of time, and that would certainly have a trickle down effect where those teams grow, and it gives the opportunity for athletes to come to the sport, and more and better athletes come to the sport. And that would certainly help develop American rowing. It has now, you know, it draws athletes from all over the world. So the best athletes from all over the world now race in the women's NCAA. So women's rowing across the planet is getting better as a result of women's rowing being an NCAA sport. But yeah, those are just a few of the factors that would contribute to it.
Okay. Yeah. What kind of, I mean, I know that a lot of the Olympic, you know, what makes or breaks the a success in Olympics is your mental training. What kind of mental training do you do along with your physical training too? And do you do that as a group or individually or both?
You know, the physical training is hand in hand with the mental training. You know, your mind is intrinsically tied to your physical body. And I think the more stable you are physically, the more stable you are mentally. You go through all of these things that challenge you, and you do it gradually. You know, you can't just stick your hand in a fire and be like, okay, now I'm used to fire. That's no, you know, it's like the slowly boiling a frog metaphor where you just gradually turn up the heat.
Yeah.
And that's really where it goes. You start with level zero and you start with something that's manageable. And then gradually week by week, day by day, week by week, year by year, you just bite off a little bit more to the point where it becomes a lot. And then you have to get, you know, really pay attention to your recovery. But we didn't really work. We had access to a sports psychologist. I wasn't really into it. So all of my mental training was just the day-to-day stuff and the self-talk. And I wrote everything down. A coach, the first year that I started training with the national team, my second pre-elite camp, kind of like, you know, that novice group camp. She said, why don't you just start writing things down? So I did. And so I started writing down, you know, anything that was technical that a coach told me. I wrote down the things that I ate, the things that I thought. I wrote down the training. And so I could really kind of, any aha moments, all that kind of stuff, that helped me build confidence over time, because we easily forget the good and glom on to the bad. And I started to notice that, sometimes it could feel like it would take 10 great days to make up for one bad one, or that one bad day or one off day could really wipe away like a week and a half of great days. It would make you focus on that and be like, man, I must be terrible at this. But then you can go back and look at what you've written down and go, oh no, like 10% of the time I'm terrible at this, you know? So there are, you know, a lot of small little things that you can do. And that resilience, I think a lot of it also wasn't just what I learned through rowing, but how I grew up being surrounded by boys, you know, playing, having a rough and tumble attitude, like being the slow kid, being the kid that didn't have confidence, being the kid that, you know, I definitely got tortured by all these boys, not tortured and like tortured literally, but like, you know, what's the better word for that? Picked on. You know, I got picked on by the guys, you know, and so to be able to. Yeah. And then a lot of my brother, I had an older brother. I played basketball with girls that were older than me. So I was always with people that were bigger than me, stronger than me, faster than me. And so to be in rowing in that environment where when I started, I was with people that were bigger than me, stronger than me, faster than me, it was just, what can I do to keep up today? And doing that little by little over time developed apparently a pretty stable mind.
and you said you started out at the bottom of the heap.
Yeah.
And so you didn't seem to be intimidated by the fact that you were in that position. You were able to rise through the
Day one jitters. Yeah. I tried to run away on my first day of practice in college. I literally turned around and was like, oh, wow, I made a mistake. And two girls that were coming to practice caught me and was like, oh, practice is this way. Plan foiled, escape foiled. And I walked in and I was really, really nervous. And I thought I made a huge mistake. And you know how when you're kind of standing up against the wall and you feel like an outsider and everything just feels cold. Mm-hmm. And the lights feel very bright and the air feels very clear. That's how I felt. And it almost felt echoey. The sound felt echoey around me. And then one of the girls on the team came over and introduced herself and just told me her name and said, hey, how's it going? Welcome to the team. And it just made me feel so much better. It told me that I'd made the right decision, you know, that it wasn't a mistake that I was there. And so that really helped. You know, she made me feel welcome on day one, and that allowed me to feel like I was part of the team. And that was that willingness of like, oh, I get to do this hard thing with cool people, you know, and that was definitely something I carried into my years with the national team was we're doing this hard thing and these are cool people, you know, and none of us at the time, at least within the group that I was sweeping with,
I heard the W. sweeping. Yeah.
Yeah. That none of us really had a huge ego, you know, at least not that got in the way of our ability to work together. And we were goofy and silly and had fun with it, you know, and I think because it was such a small group in the beginning, I didn't realize just how much slower I was than everybody else. And that also helped. And I think the other cool thing about rowing is that even when not everything's going right, there's always something that you're doing because you do a lot of cross training, something that you're doing that you can be improving. Even if you're not improving relative to the rest of the group, you within yourself are improving. And so that keeps you motivated over time until eventually, you know, one day, all of a sudden you make a technical improvement that also allows you to gain ground on the rest of the group as well and start pushing the rest of the group in a different way.
So you say you do cross training. So what is your training like? I mean, I'm sure it's more than just rowing. I would imagine. What kind of you're talking about injury prevention. So what are the kinds of things that that you look at to help make an athlete all around.
You know, I was going to say for injury prevention, you know, running is the same way. You need to cross train because otherwise that's the overuse right there. So, you know, you're going to cross train in all the ways. So you're going to row on the water. You're going to row a lot of different types of boats. You might row both sides of the boat and you will certainly scull and sweep. You'll lift weights of all kinds, you know, different rep schemes, high load, short reps, high rep, low load, and move in all sorts of planes of motion. We row on the rowing machine. You bike. We even went on cross country skiing adventures sometimes, which was pretty awesome. But those are the key things that you'll do. And some swimming as well for more of kind of a recovery where it just takes the load off the body altogether. Didn't swim as much simply because, you know, it is so different and there are other ways to cross train, but we swam a little bit, which was nice.
What kind of diet did you have to follow? Do you have anything particular that worked for you?
Trial and error, write everything down. I went to my first world championships eating granola bars, cereal, and toast because that's what I liked. You know, my diet was not at a lack of carbohydrate. For sure. I actually, my whole life, have never been a huge meat eater. I've never liked eating eggs. I do now. I love eating eggs now, but I never liked red meat my whole life. And, you know, I could probably be vegetarian if not for shellfish and pulled pork barbecue, even though I don't eat pork anymore. But no, we had a, barbecue. Yeah, I don't eat pork anymore,
but I like that.
Yeah.
Well, this is Kansas City. I mean, we're proud of our barbecue.
But you know, I realize also now in retrospect that the most important things that I did was I slept a lot. I made sure I stayed hydrated. I ate a lot of fruits and vegetables. And, you know, we didn't have as many options when I first started training in terms of like quinoa and amaranth and buckwheat and all the different things. I ate a lot of beans. I ate a lot of toast and I ate a lot of whole wheat pasta. You know, my pre-hard training session meal the night before, I would eat, you know, like some sort of whole wheat pasta because that's what I could afford. Spinach and like a soy chicken patty. You know, like I would eat something protein. I would eat a nice green and I would eat some sort of like semi-hearty carbohydrate. And that was what I did. Now, having studied nutrition and having more options that are affordable and available, I would, you know, diversify certain things, but I certainly had the bones to a really supportive diet because I did not have an injury for the first 7.5 years that I rode, which was rare. And I think part of it was the sleep. Yeah, was the sleep. And ability to move really, really well. And the fact that I did not restrict. When you're training that much, you cannot be restrictive in your diet. You can fail a drug test if you're taking supplements. So I never took a supplement. I did not drink coffee until I stopped training. So I didn't have disruptions to my gut microbiome. I didn't have the extra acidity in my body. I didn't have the extra stress in my body. I think that all of those things were small things that really went a long way. Yeah, supplements are called supplements for a reason. They are meant to supplement the diet that you hone to the best of your ability. And if you are omitting the basics, the keys, then you're doing yourself a huge disservice.
So that's interesting. And so, yeah, you said supplements could trigger you to fail a drug test for the competitions.
The NCAA follows the same rules as the World Anti-Doping Agency. If you, you know, and even because the FDA doesn't regulate supplements, right? So whatever it says on the label isn't necessarily in the container. And you could have two of the same product of the same brand, and they could have inconsistent amounts of whatever is in that supplement. And they can also be tainted. Yes, there are better practices and clean, good, you know, I can't remember what the labels are, but they're gold standards, but there's still risk involved. And it was not worth it to me to put that risk on the table, because if I were to fail a drug test, my entire team would lose as a result. It wouldn't just be me. So I did not even take a multivitamin or Tums with calcium. You know what I mean? That's how I was. I did not want to risk it. Too much effort.
It sounds very extreme, but you know, when you explain it, you know, it's things that I think most of us have never thought of before, because we tend to, you know, look at the label and go, oh yeah, it's fine.
Mm-hmm. And now, again, having studied nutrition, you know, bioavailability is different. So how you process that pill form versus the plant form, those are two different things, you know, and it's all about what you're consuming things with. So there really is a lot to be said for making sure that you're anchoring your diet in the good old things. I even, gosh, did a project when I was in graduate school on eating for nutrition or injury prevention. And what do you find at the end of it is you go through, dive through all this research. And it tells you to eat colors, eat nuts, eat seeds, eat beans, eat shellfish, eat lean meat if you eat meat, you know. So it's exactly what the nutritionist would say. Eat your fruits and vegetables, get your sleep. You know? It's actually not that far off.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, and I know there's a lot of different options. I mean, there was a movement in ultra marathon runners of running fasted or running, you know, they call it fat adapted. And so they're eating high fats and
plant-based in particular.
I've seen a lot of different, and for there, I think some people that will work for, but you know, not everyone is the same. And
And the thing too, is the longer that you go for, the more that you can be reliant on fats. Like if you're going for hours of time, you have to train your body to consume those things. It's the, short periods of time, those anaerobic activities that you cannot fuel on fat alone, for sure. It'll diminish your capacity to produce super high intensity effort. But for prolonged periods of time, you have to, just because of the energy required to continue for that long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because a lot of the ultramarathon runners are running for, you know, even the fastest ones are running 20 hours for some of the races.
And
those of us at the back of the pack are running 30.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, 20, anything over, you know, 45 minutes or an hour, you definitely need to get into the wet beta oxidation. So totally understandable.
Yeah, but it's also a much slower pace. I mean, ultra runners are not relying upon that, looking for that explosive energy.
So. Yeah, exactly.
And you're a coach now. You're a coach and a speaker and an author. Talk a little bit about your life after the Olympics.
Yeah, you know, I went back after the games. I was planning on rowing for as long as I possibly could. Ultimately did too much too soon. Still had the mentality of my Olympic day self. And after I retired, ended up doing ocean rescue because that was something that I always wanted to do ever since I was a kid, and kind of fell into coaching after that and fell in love with coaching, which ended up resulting in getting my master's in exercise physiology, which has since led to a lot of really looking at stroke mechanics and keeping people healthy. Like, how did I stay healthy? How can I help create, you know, how did I have such a fantastic team experience? How can I help create that environment, those situations for other people, perpetuating the positive? Which is why I said, you know, now I'm interested in potentially doing the PhD. Like, it's just incredibly interesting to look at how simple the stroke can be and how we overcomplicate it and how you can go fast for a long time. My interests are certainly, you know, not just, you know, the speed part of it, but when you look at the speed itself and you do the right things by speed, you are going to help people stay healthy. You're going to help them keep in the sport for a long period of time, for the whole life. Running, you know, is something that you can do for a lifetime when you do it right. Rowing is the same. You just get to sit, which is an added benefit. With the coaching, I coach at all levels. I was coaching in the NCAA up until about 3 years ago. Now I coach privately. So I do clinics and camps predominantly around all over the country, all over the world. Now, actually, I'll be coaching a camp in Portugal in September. A couple of camps. I mean, this year I'm coaching about 8 or 10 different camps throughout the world. And anything from a few hours long to a week long, maybe 2 weeks long. But as far as speaking, you know, I speak with company schools, all kinds of different entities about lots of different themes. Teamwork being a very common theme that I speak on. interpersonal relationships. You know, I talk about the mentality of it, of sport, of how those habits translate to life, longevity in sport, lots of different topics, especially now that I'm kind of diverted into the science of it. I love teaching. I love coaching. It's just, I know what sport has done for me. And I do now see it as as one of our most powerful vehicles for development and social change, you know, in positive ways when done right. Part of that, I also work with the Positive Coaching Alliance to do workshops for young people, coaches, administrators, and their parents to help remedy sport, you know, really help youth sport in particular.
Help coaches to coach better.
Yeah. Yeah. And not specifically with rowing, but kind of the concepts of developing team and building better athletes or building better people through sport itself, you know, leadership and teamwork and communication and all of these different things. I feel very fortunate to get to work with them and deliver those workshops too. So, and if you can't tell, I like to talk, yes. Hence the book. Oh, no, <that's, laughs> I love telling stories.
That's, I love guests who love to talk. That's great. Well, you talk about coaches. I mean, any parent who has a child in any kind of sport, you know, you get to see good coaches and bad coaches in,
yes.
You know, whether it's soccer, baseball, you know, football,
every sport you need.
And you sit in the game, and, you know, even if you have a great coach, you know, my grandkids have had coaches from the other team say just terrible, hurtful. I mean, something mm-hmm. no adult mm-hmm. should say to, you know, yeah. a child.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, as the teams are, you know, moving, you know, back and forth, and that just, and it can just, those can be devastating for a lifetime. Yes.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And then good coaches can have the same thing, the same effect in the other way.
Yes. And that was actually one of the really fun things about patterning when I did write my first book. I say my first book because I have other books that I want to write for sure. It's just the power.
So the name of your first book is?
Better Great Than Never. Yeah.
Better Great Than Never.
Yeah. It's a play on the, instead of Better Late, right? Better Great Than Never.
Better Great Than Never.
What? Yeah. I mean, you know, because when you go for something, you know, if you go all in on it, you're going to be better than you would have ever been had you never gone for it in the first place. So no matter what happens, you're going to be better than you ever would have been. So better great than never.
I love that. Yeah. And you said you were talking about patterning. I interrupted you. I apologize.
Oh, with the coaches, you know, it's people, when you look at sport, you know, where do the most people participate? At the youth level, but there isn't always the resource there. The resource isn't always available. The schedule, the location, the facility, the coaching, you know, we need a large volume of coaches to accommodate the number of people at sport at the youth level, but we just don't have that. You know, it often ends up, you know, you do have some great coaches, but there are not enough that are trained there. You were just mentioning, you know, the way that they might speak to the kids for better or for worse, you know, and some of it is innate characteristics and some of it is, you know, the people are good at the sport, but not good at coaching. We see that all the time. You have fantastic athletes that compete, win the Olympics, but they don't like coaching or they just aren't good at coaching, you know, and vice versa can happen. Someone maybe is okay at the sport, but they become a phenomenal coach because they are a student of the sport. They love the science behind it. I am now more of a rowing nerd than I ever was while I was actually rowing, you know, now that I'm coaching. Because I find it fascinating simply because I understand more about how the body works. And that's what I love teaching is I look at it. I had a professor in grad school, one of my favorite advisors and mentors. He said, you know, there are architects and carpenters and your job is to be an architect. So to be able to look at it and go, okay, how can I communicate this? Not just for athletes, but for coaches too, because there's only one of me. You know, I can only work mm-hmm. with so many people at a time. If I can help other people, other coaches, other athletes be more intuitive about what they're doing, learn the concept, and then develop their own ways of implementing it, that's far more effective. Yeah,
that's great. That's great. So how can people get a hold of you if they wanted to follow you on social media or learn more about what you have, what you do?
Yeah, a couple of things.
Connect with you.
My name. Like Lindsay Dare Shoop. You can find me on Instagram. If you follow social media, that's the one I respond the most quickly to. You can Google me as well, Lindsay Shoop Rowing, and all sorts of things will pop up. But you can find me certainly very easily at Lindsay Dare Shoop on Instagram. You can also find me on my website at lindsaydareshoop.com. And I will.
Okay, great.
Yeah, reachable there, both of those ways.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Lindsay. Before I let you go, I have a tradition that I have started just this year in my podcast. I call these the bridge questions.
Oh.
Who approacheth the bridge of death must answer me these questions three. The other side he see.
Ask me the questions, bridge keeper. I'm not afraid.
First question is, as a coach, what do you think is the most effective exercise that a person can do all around? But if there were one exercise that could kind of give you the best benefits?
You mean physical exercise or
physical exercise?
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I like rowing. between rowing and swimming, combine those two things, because one is forward and one allows you to be kind of unravel all of the things. I kind of joke now that if we all jumped in a pool and did backflips all day, that would probably remedy a lot of the ills of gravity. Yep.
Okay. Question number two, your best diet advice. You touched on it earlier, but I would say what is your best for somebody who's looking for great health? What's your best advice for diet?
This might not sound like a diet advice, but it is. Sleep. Get your sleep, because if you don't, it's going to impact your hormones, which is going to make you crave things that are not good for you. The more that you sleep, the more that you will crave healthy foods. So
that's a very unusual answer, but I can see the wisdom of that.
Yeah. I mean, I could go on from there, or maybe I should say sleep, hydrate, eat your colors.
But sleep is still first. I like that. Yes. I like that. Yeah. That's good. Okay. Yeah. Question number three, what word or phrase sums up your philosophy of life?
Sure. I don't want to say better great than never. I have one on my wall that the more you know, the less you need. It's a quote by the founder of Patagonia. The more you know, the less you need.
The more you know, the less you need.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's good.
The founder of Patagonia. That's not mine. I take it from him. Paint it on my wall.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and you know somebody who might like it as well, please take just a minute, send them a link so they can listen. And if you enjoy most of the episodes, please tell your friends. That's the best compliment you can give. I truly enjoy being able to spend time here with you each week, and I appreciate that you take the time to listen. If you have any comments, questions, or stories that you'd like to share, go to ultramindsetpodcast.run. And you can leave a written or a voice message. You can also find the show notes for this episode and more at the same link, ultramindsetpodcast.run. Remember, it takes an ultramarathon mindset to go the distance in running and in life, and a strong mindset is a skill you can learn. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.